You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show with Chris Webster on KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson Community Media in Carson City, Nevada, and online at knvc.org/listen-live. Welcome to the show. Hello, listeners and fans of archaeology. I'm your host for the next hour, Chris Webster. I'm a contract archaeologist in a field we call cultural resource management. I also run the Archaeology Podcast Network. We have lots of shows about archaeology, and you can find them all at www.archpodnet.com. Today will be a recap and discussion about my last 3 weeks out in the field and some issues that came up as a result. I'm hoping to have some discussions and take your questions. Speaking of questions, this is first and foremost a call-in show. Call in with your questions to 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to @ArchaeoWebby, and that's ArchaeoWebby, or @ArchPodNet, or send in an email, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Of course, all that's really difficult to manage, so if I miss it, apologies. But hopefully we can get something in here. Because to be honest, folks, I do podcasts, and podcasts are a one-way communication device. It's very hard to get communication back on a podcast. I mean, sure, some people send in questions, but having that immediate feedback is why I started this radio show. So if you're listening to this, if you're enjoying it, even if you want to call in and just say, hey, you know, that all sounds great, then please call in so we know people are listening and people are enjoying the content and people are engaging with the content, which is the entire point of me doing this show and really everything that I do. So if you want to call in about anything on this show any single time, not just the topic at hand, I mean, if I have a guest, then, you know, maybe we'll do that, but there's no guest today. But feel free to call in with your questions about anything about archaeology, history, archaeology on TV. There's a lot of different things out there that can be confusing or misleading because, you know, it's TV and they have ratings to worry about, not facts. Or if you have questions about finding things on your property, especially you local people living in Nevada here or down in the Carson Valley, there's a lot of archaeology right in your backyard, and you may have found something, you may have questions about it. I don't do appraisals, and I can also talk about why that is, but I can talk about, you know, possibly what the artifacts are and what they mean. I don't know everything, but I do know a fair amount of things, so or at least I can point you in the right direction. So anyway, that phone number one more time is 775-515-4141. As I said, I've been gone for 3 weeks, so I had some recorded episodes from the Archaeology Show podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network over at, again, archpodnet.com/archaeology. And I want to know what you guys thought about these things. So they've been playing. I did a little bit of reworking to them for the radio show. But they're still really great episodes, and that's what I love about doing the podcast is they're you know, they're like a catalog or a I guess a back catalog of just awesome educational information, which is why I like playing them on this radio show in this time slot when I have to be out of town. The first week, so 3 weeks ago, I guess technically 4 weeks ago, we talked to Billy Griffiths, who is an author and archaeologist in Australia, about his book, Deep Time Dreaming. He's an Australian archaeologist, and in Deep Time Dreaming is about coming to terms with the massive antiquity of a land and a people that identify with that land. So that's such an interesting concept, and it was such a great show to record because, you know, as far as we know, I think people came to Australia something like Homo sapiens came to Australia something like 40 to 60,000 years ago. Of course, we all hear the stories about you know, Britain sending their convicts there, which is also true. But there were people there long before that. The Aboriginal people of Australia are there before that. In fact, that's where we get the term Aboriginal. We call them Aborigines, and, you know, they're the original people on the land of Australia. And they have a massive history, and they call their own history deep time, you know, deep time dreaming and that whole concept. So it's really interesting to sit and think about that. And often when I'm on a prehistoric archaeology site, which I'll talk a little bit about here in a few minutes. But often when I'm on a prehistoric archaeology site, I will think about, you know, what did this landscape look like when people were here before. What were they doing? What were they thinking? What were they, you know, what were their issues? You know, when I'm sitting there, I'm thinking lots of things. You know, I've got email that needs to be checked. I've got, you know, probably just got a text message. Something on Slack came through. And in the meantime, I'm thinking about logistics. I'm a crew chief or I'm a field director. When's our next break? When can I get my people a break? When can we get our lunch scheduled? But then sometimes you just got to sit down and think, okay, I'm recording this prehistoric pottery. We find a lot of things that are called pot drops, just kind of a quick term for it. Basically, something was dropped or left there. We don't know if it was, you know, somebody moving across the landscape and they dropped it. But a pot drop is typically a term for a ceramic pot of some sort. And that's the only thing there. You don't find any other artifacts in association. If you found what we call groundstone or things related to more sedentary activities, like some sort of temporary campsite or habitation site, then that says something different about it. But if all you find across the entire landscape in this one area is ceramic sherds, and sherd is the term. I found out a couple weeks ago that people don't know the term sherd. Sherd refers to ceramic pieces. Shard refers to glass pieces. So there's your little education for the day. But if you find this pot drop, and it's just, they're all the same. They're all the same color, maybe the same decoration if there is any, same motif if there's something painted on it, or, you know, something like that. And they're usually in close proximity to each other, maybe within a few feet of each other, you know, 3 to 6 feet or 1 to 2 meters. And that is typically a single event, we call it. So, or what we call a pot drop in that case. There's other things that can be single events like that, but that's one that particularly comes to mind. So I like to think when I see that kind of thing, okay, where were they going? What were they doing? Was this a kid? Did somebody say, here, hold on to this? And then they tripped over a rock and dropped it. I mean, those tiny little details are the details that make history, I guess, come alive. And the details that make that what we find become real and not just data that we're writing down on a piece of paper or in a tablet and recording. You know, it makes these real people. And it's weird to say that because, of course, they're real people. But sometimes as archaeologists, we just get into the science and we get into the doing of the thing. And we don't step back and say, oh, right, this was a person that did this, a person that had real concerns, you know, like, hey, that, you know, glacier's looking really big, or, you know, the lake is going away. In the particular case of a few weeks ago, there was a lake there in prehistoric times, and I can't remember what the name of the lake was, Lake Coe or something like that. Anyway, there was a lake there in prehistoric times, so a lot of people were having activities around this lake, and we know generally where the lake was, the lake edge was at different periods of time, because lake edges in your lifetime might be constant. You know, the edges of Lake Tahoe don't move very much. That's a bad example because it's bounded by mountains. But let's say Pyramid Lake up here in Nevada. You know, that lake, the edges don't really move that much. You know, they might move a little bit seasonally, but they don't typically move that much. But Pyramid Lake was part of a bigger lake called Lake Lahontan, which covered this entire area. It was the biggest inland sea of its time in that era. And there still is a Lake Lahontan outside Carson City. But that's not the original Lake Lahontan. It's part of it, but there's a lot of different lakes that were part of this Lake Lahontan. So people that lived back in that time will be looking at this lake edge, and maybe in their own lifetime, the lake edge also didn't move. But then a couple generations back, they look back and they say, hey, our village used to be, you know, that way, many feet, whatever they called it. You know, it was a 5-minute walk that way, and now it's here. And what's going on here? You know, they may not have understood what was happening or anything like that, but that's problematic. So that's what I think of when I think of deep time dreaming. I like to get out there. You know, in the end, you know, you're working a job and you got to get the work done. But if we do have a chance to sit down and just really think about it, then I like to do that. So That was Billy Griffiths. If you have any comments on that episode from 3 weeks ago, if you heard it, I'd love to know your thoughts on that. Again, 775-515-4141. You can call in or send an email, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. I am attempting to keep an eye on that while we're doing the show here. So, okay, so in the second week of the show, we talked about nationalism and tribalism. So let me back up just a second, though, because we have something tied to this. The Section 106 process is what is typically called when we do the the process of archaeology. And before I get into that, we do have a question online too. So I'm going to bring Joe in online too right now. Hopefully I don't drop the call. All right, so I'm bringing Joe in right now. I know he's on one of these phone lines. How about that? Joe, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Chris. I love your program, man.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. What's your question?
Our question is, my wife and I, Ann, love to camp in Nevada.
Yeah.
And one of the as we drive around, one of the things that always intrigues us are all the dry lakes that are just prevalent in Nevada. And we know they're dry lakes. We look out there, we see them, but we know that there was something else going on in prehistoric time that was more like the normal lake kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I'm not using technical terms. Can you
sure.
talk in terms of the dry lake phenomenon in the Great Basin?
So yeah, thanks for your question, Joe. So it's interesting with dry lakes. So let me back up and talk about geology just for a second here. Lakes have a unique ability to take in sediment just from the air, because there's sediment in rain. There's sediment that comes in through through washes down the mountainsides into lakes areas. And one of the unique things about a lake is it tends to, because of the way water works, if you've ever put like sand in a bucket or something like that, it tends to lay flat. Or if you've ever walked on a beach, right, the sand tends to lay flat because water has that settling effect on sediment. So anywhere you see mountains on the edges, like the Carson Valley, like Reno, the Truckee Meadows, anytime you see mountains on the edges and flat in the middle, chances are there was a lake there. It may have been 20, 30, 40,000 years ago, but chances are there was a lake there, and it filled in these areas of mountains, and it filled in these sediments, and it made it all level and flat. And that's another reason why when we look at mountains in Nevada and we go out and we drive around and we see these uplifts and these all these layers, those layers are flat for usually one of two reasons. Now, I'm not a geologist, so if there is a geologist listening, feel free to call in and correct me. But those lakes, those layers are flat for one of two reasons. Typically, they were laid down as lake sediments in some cases, or it could just be geological time and pressure has flattened these things out. So to address your question, Joe, about the dry lake beds, those are just more recent episodes of that. So we go through cycles of, you know, wet and dry periods in this world. There's different cycles. We're not really talking about, you know, human climate change or anything like that. We're talking about natural climate change, and we go through these cycles. So these dry lakes are places, and in Nevada, they can become wet lakes really, really fast. But typically, they're dry lakes because their source of water has dried up. Now, maybe there was an underground aquifer somewhere, or maybe the environment was completely different, but typically there was some sort of underground water source that was up in the mountains or somewhere nearby, and it fed into this lake, and it did it for long enough that we recognize it as a lake bed now. And prehistorically, they also would have recognized that as a lake bed, and that would have been a nice source for food, because other animals come to these sources of water. Other things grow there as a result of the water, and it was just a great place to go and live and hang out and get stuff. So dry lakes in Nevada are really great places for archaeologists to go find archaeological sites. And the neat thing about dry lakes is they used to be, as I said, probably wet lakes. And if they're around for any length of time, and if they're in some sort of basin, they've probably been around for a really long time, then you can look up the sides of the hills, and you can typically see these sort of flatter areas up in the hills. And those are places at which the lake level was like that for an extended period of time, because the wave action of the lake would have created these shorelines. We call them ancient shorelines or paleo shorelines. And the higher up you go, typically the farther back in time you're going, because lakes tend to get shallower through time. And the higher up you go, the older sites you'll find. So if you want to find older archaeological sites, you just look up higher in the hills on those shorelines. So I don't know if that rambling answer satisfied your curiosity, Joe.
No, it really does, because we tend to, as non-archaeologists, look at them and create our own story behind them. And that's always the most fun, is imagining what was going on. And what's also beautiful about the Nevada dry lakes is you're driving or walking, camping, whatever you're doing, and you see them in the distance, they glimmer. There's this beautiful white appearance of them that has them stand out. And I'm assuming the again, it's a, I guess, a question for a geologist, but what's the cause of that beautiful white shimmering look?
Yeah, well, it could be one of two things from my own experience. First off, it could just be heat coming off the lake and you're off in a distance. You know, it's that kind of mirage effect of heat coming off of that sort of surface, especially if it's got a little bit of moisture left in it. For example, in a lot of these dry lake beds, if you get out in the middle and you just, you know, dig down 6 inches, 12 inches, you might find actual wet soil. And that when the heat of the afternoon picks up here in the Great Basin, that moisture comes up and that evaporation causes that shimmering mirage-like effect if you're in the right angle of it to the sun and all that. Now, of course, the other thing is that whitish look to it. There's a lot of salt in natural soil, and these salts come up with the water, and then when the water goes away and dissolves, all you're left with is those salts. That's why you actually see in some places where the salt is more prevalent, you see salt mines and salt operations. I think there's one out near Fallon. When you go past Fallon, there's a dry lake out there.
I've been to that location. Actually, that family has been around forever in Fallon.
Mm-hmm.
That is the hardest work. I mean, you know, the old cliche of being sent to the salt mine.
Oh,
that is a salt mine, and they stand in water.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just remarkable what that business is, and they consider them miners. Isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
And I guess they're mining salt, but, but it's not a place where tourists are going to go and
sure.
see what's going on, but I was fortunate enough to be able to see it years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I had a different life and different job, and it was just fascinating. So,
yeah, it is. Well, thank you for your call, Joe. Yeah, do you got anything else?
Yeah, I got one more question
okay.
for you. I live up in Silver City. I don't know if you're familiar with Silver
mm-hmm.
City. It's in the Comstock, and there's a community up here, Silver City community, that is to a person opposed to a mining operation that's right nearby,
mm-hmm.
That's threatening their community. And I tell you this story because part of the resistance to that mining operation, Silver City seems to have it way beyond percentage population of archaeologists.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's fascinating about archaeologists, and I know that you can test this, is the research skills that archaeologists possess. Not only can they get into really refined detail in their research, but then they're really good writers and narrators of that research. They can translate that research into something that's readable for the general public. So
mm-hmm.
My hat's off to all archaeologists because I've watched how hard they, how deep their research skills are, how extensive they are, and how valuable they are. So if you're ever up in Silver City, I'll introduce you to some of these kind of characters that are actually professional archaeologists.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and thanks for that because it's one thing I like people to know about archaeology is that it's a profession of people that are really passionate about what they do, because to be honest, there's not a whole lot of money in archaeology. I mean, you go out and do work.
They can all attest to that, yes.
yeah. Whether you're getting paid as a college professor or, you know, as a cultural resource management archaeologist like myself, I mean, there just simply isn't a lot of money in that profession. And so we do this because we love history and we love telling stories about history. And that's one thing I've started to tell people in the last couple of years, especially through the podcast network, is one of the most common questions archaeologists get is what's the coolest thing you've ever found, and or what's a cool site you've been on or something like that. And I try to I deflate them a little bit and I say, well, I don't like to talk about artifacts in that way because that's usually what they're talking about. What's the coolest artifact you found? What's the coolest thing you found? But glorifying the things of archaeology, even buildings and stuff like that, glorifying the things takes away from the history and the story, I think. The things help tell the story, But the things are only one small part of the story. I mean, just to bring it back to relevant times, the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral, you know, I mean, we lost a lot of Notre Dame Cathedral and they're going to rebuild, obviously, but we lost the original history of a lot of that place. But we have a lot of the stories. We have a lot of the things that were, you know, as a result of that, because, you know, the church has obviously kept that going and they've got all the stories and documentation about what's gone on there. And that's something that can never be taken away. You know, we can rebuild the structure, but the stories will always be there. And then we'll build new stories based on the new things that are there. So that's what I like to tell people. So anyway, thank you for that, Joe.
All right. Great program. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Chris Webster here with the Archaeology Podcast Network. And if you like what you're hearing, considering becoming a member and supporting us, go over to archpodnet.com/members and support us at the supporting member level, standard member, or professional member. You can do $5, $10, or $20 a month, and you can do those yearly at $42, $84, or $168 per year. Again, that's archpodnet.com/members for more information. Get early downloads, show stickers, and a whole bunch of other swag. So, yeah, I mean, this is awesome. You know, what are your thoughts on archaeology and what I just said there about really about honestly the concept of what this all means. You know, what this all means to you. You know, what are your own how do your own artifacts tell a story about you? That's one thing people don't think about. Like, look down at your desk or living room or kitchen or car or something like that, and if something sitting right there, or even your entire house, if you were suddenly disappeared tomorrow and the only thing we had left was that, and people who don't know you tried to tell your story based on your things, what would that story be? You know, what would that story look like based on the things that you own and the things that you have around you? How would we tell that story? There is a great book. I can't remember the author, so I'll have to look this up, but it's called The Nasorema. And it's about analyzing basically what became an archaeological site, you know, decades or years later. It's kind of a thought experiment. And they're analyzing these things to tell the story. Nasorema is American spelled backwards. And, you know, you realize when they're trying to tell this story that when they're talking about a toothbrush and describing a toothbrush, we're assuming that the people or society describing these things have never seen these things before. And they don't know what they are. So they're trying to describe them and figure out what these things are and what their uses are. And, I mean, that goes back to a comic I saw one time where it was like, you know, thousands of years in the future and there's aliens standing there and you see a freeway, like a freeway interstate overpass, like something that's been built up with the concrete pillars beneath it. But the only thing left are the concrete pillars and the freeway's gone and there's no buildings and there's no anything. It's just sitting out in this desert. And so for some reason, these concrete pillars are there. And they're saying, oh, it must have been some ritualistic society, and these are their, you know, these are their gods or something like that. I thought that was particularly funny to an archaeologist because it's kind of a joke, but it's also kind of true that if we don't understand what something was used for, then we kind of default to saying it was ritual because a lot of things actually are ritual, to be honest. But when we say, oh, I don't know what that is because it's not in my worldview, it's not in my frame of reference, then, you know, it must be ritual. So. All right, so back to a quick recap of the last couple of weeks. The second episode we had while I was gone was about nationalism and tribalism. So this is a topic I'm really passionate about, and it's one that I think gets us as a people and a world in trouble more often than not. There's also a concept that we don't talk about called cultural relativism, and I'll get to that in a second. But first, tribalism is a concept that goes back to our roots as human beings, even before that, to be honest, our roots as, you know, hominids and the primates we were before, well, still primates, but the pre-hominid primates that we were before that, and really lots of different animal species have this. So what I'm talking about is that sort of evolutionary desire and need to protect your family, okay? We had that. Lots of animals have that. You know, it's not unique. It's something that is born out of an evolutionary need to procreate and to pass on your genetic material. And the way to do that is to protect your family, you know, to ensure that, you know, your baby or infant's not going to be, you know, killed or something, or the mother back in the day is not going to be killed and can help raise that infant. And then you can keep on going and making more babies. And that really is the point of evolution. So, But that sort of thought and desire has been so many hundreds of thousands of years born into our psyche, that tribalism is the concept of taking that family protection idea and then expanding that out. So when we were smaller families and we started banding together, or our extended families started not moving out and staying around us, we had a bigger unit. And that bigger unit was you know, called a group or a band. And then now that band became kind of your family. And the desire to protect that band became a bigger version of tribalism. And then when bands started sticking together into cities and city-states, then the concept of protecting your entire city became a thing. You know, that's still tribalism. And now take that down all the way to today, and we have the concept of obviously countries, even continents, but really more likely countries. And, you know, we want to fiercely protect our country and everything within it as it was, as if it were our family. And I don't know, to me, this really, you know, this is an evolutionary concept. It's a cultural concept as well. But it's such a dangerous one, because we got to really sit back and consider, what are we trying to protect? There's no wrong thing about protecting that stuff or wanting to protect those things and wanting to protect those values. But what are we trying to protect? You know, we just got to make sure we're not trying to protect against new culture, new influence. I mean, the concept of the American way is something that people try to protect. But even that is only about 70 years old as we know it right now. And, you know, we're a country defined by change and defined by influence from other cultures. And, you know, without cultural influences, we never have the concept of things like, you know, Taco Tuesday, which I think we can all agree on is something that we need in this world. I mean, who doesn't love tacos? So anyway, be careful with tribalism. Be careful with nationalism. They're good concepts. They help protect us inherently. And you know, the whole, you know, protecting your family and all that stuff. But they can be quite problematic. So anyway, I want to talk to Brad now. He's a fan of the show. So Brad called and said he's a fan of the show and doesn't have a question. Thank you for calling in, Brad. I really appreciate that. I've been doing the show since December, and it's just good to know that people can hear it and people are listening and people are getting something out of it. So like I've said before, this is first and foremost an educational show. Okay, so finally, last week, you heard from Chris Williamson, who is the director and creator of a new documentary project coming out. It's not just one episode. I think they're ending up with like 10 episodes. It's called The Chasing Earhart Project. And it's all about Amelia Earhart, and not just about the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, but the search for Amelia Earhart, but Amelia Earhart's life. You know, what led her to become a pilot? How was she as a, you know, what kind of woman was she? What kind of child was she? He was so interested in these concepts that he moved his entire family to Atchison, Kansas, where she was born and where she grew up. She ended up living on the East Coast, of course, but she was born and grown up there. And there's a museum in Atchison, I want to say, and there's, you know, a statue to her and all kinds of stuff. And there's people, wow, I don't know if there's people that remember her, but there's definitely descendants of people that remember her, you know, and her family as they were living there. So keep an eye out for that documentary. It's going to be pretty great, because there's a lot of misinformation about Amelia Earhart out there. There's a woman who I think they interview in the documentary who people think is Amelia Earhart, just like in hiding. And first off, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, she was famous and popular and enjoyed the spotlight. And what would cause her to go into hiding and then, you know, take on an alias or another name? That's a really weird concept to think about. So there's also, I believe it was a National Geographic show a couple years ago, on her, and they thought that maybe she was stuck in this prison. There's a photo, a Japanese photo, of her standing on these docks, like she was taken prisoner, her and Fred Noonan, and there's somebody, I think, kneeling down that kind of looks like Amelia Earhart from behind. I mean, it's really dubious. Of course, the photograph was immediately debunked by somebody who knows what the heck they're talking about right after the show came out, because the dates are all wrong. The dates don't make any sense. And then the search for her, where most credible researchers think that they probably went down or near where they went down and probably lived for a little while, perhaps with injuries, I don't know, but is Nikumaroro Island. And that's over in the Atlantic. And Tom King is an archaeologist who worked with the TIGAR project, which is the basically it's a group. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's a group that searches for historic aircraft wrecks and things like that. And I've interviewed Tom King before on the Archaeology Podcast Network. Actually, if you go over there to archpodnet.com and type in Tom King, you'll see a bunch of different episodes where we talked to him. And we actually did talk to him about the his research with the Amelia Earhart Project as well. So all that's great. And I hope you guys got some interesting quality stuff out of that. So we're going to take just a short break right now. We're going to come back, and I will talk to you all about my work near the Mexican border for the last 3 weeks.
She had a fire. I was bright, but she was much brighter. I was high, but she was the sky. Oh, baby, I was bound for Mexico. Oh, baby, I was bound to let you go.
Right. I love that song. It's called Mexico by Cake. All right. So welcome back to the Archaeology Show. This is 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media, Carson Community Media in Carson City, Nevada. This is Chris Webster, and we're going to talk about my work down near the Mexican border these last few weeks. Call in with your questions at 775-515-4141. As I'm talking about this, I'm really interested in not the political discussion about border and immigration policy, but really more of a philosophical, cultural discussion about it, because we've always had borders, whether you like it or not. We've always had borders, even if it's just somebody staking out a claim on a ridge and saying, don't come near me. That's a border, right? And we've just formalized those borders with walls and fences and guns and documents and things like that. But we basically always had borders. But I want to think about what a world would look like without borders, just philosophically as a thought experiment. You know, what are your thoughts on that? What would that look like? Not immediately following the reduction of all the borders and the removal of all borders across the planet, but 100 years later. What's that look like? You know, is it Star Trek? Are we one planet amongst a federation of planets? Or is it, you know, completely impossible? Is it something we can never achieve, you know, as a society? And think about it this way, too. The United States of America was, you know, our borders have constantly changed. I mean, not so much lately, but we added Alaska like 70 years ago. We added Hawaii We might be adding some more states. We might be splitting up some states and making new ones. Borders are completely arbitrary. They're a cultural construct. That goes back to what I said in the last segment that I never actually got to again about cultural relativism, which is basically all the morals and ethics of a culture are typically right at the time. They might not be right in 100 years when you look back through the lens of history, but they're right at the time. And that goes with borders. You know, borders right now seem like, yeah, it totally makes sense. We have a border with Mexico and a border with Canada and a border with California and, you know, a border with Lake Tahoe that happens to be a mountain. And, you know, we have all these borders. But will those borders make any sense in 100 years? And that's what I want people to, you know, think about and call in. 775-515-4141. So now let's talk about cultural resource management, or CRM, archaeology, and what I was doing for the past 3 weeks. So without getting into any discussion of clients or anything like that, because that's typically not stuff we're allowed to talk about, just because, not for any secrecy reason, it wasn't the government, but, you know, it's just client confidentiality type stuff. So one of the reasons that we do archaeology is as a result of the National Historic Preservation Act and one tiny paragraph called Section 106. And that's actually changed. If you go try to look it up now, they changed the whole numbering system, but we still call it Section 106 because there's a whole concept and books and classes you can take on the Section 106 process. And basically what that means is that if there's a project happening on government, either on government land or land that requires a government permit. So let's say you're putting up a cell tower on private land. That's an FCC permit, and that requires Section 106. And it also probably requires some work called a NEPA project too, National Environmental Policy Act, but that's a different thing. So what we were doing is basically a huge transmission line survey, a proposed transmission line. They may not even do it, but they had to check the land out first. And we walk over this land, and what we're doing is what Section 106 tells us to do is to evaluate the effects or impacts of an undertaking on a cultural resource. So one of the first stages of that process is to identify the cultural resources. And depending on the area, that can be done in a number of different ways. Let's say back east in the east coast of the United States, there's a lot of what we call soil deposition from hurricanes, from, you know, trees and vegetation. All that stuff creates soil. So artifacts and features and sites get buried very quickly. So when we do an initial survey to find out what's there, on the East Coast, we do what's called shovel testing. We walk across the landscape, and you typically every 10 to 30 meters, depending on the area and depending on the history that we already know and what we call the site density that's possible there, we'll decide this interval, and we'll dig a hole down to either the water table or as far as our shovel will reach and see what's there. And then we'll take all the data that we collect from the shovel test and say, okay, so we had a whole bunch of positive shovel tests over here, which means something was in it. And we need to go do further investigation there. So then we'll go to the next phase, typically called phase two, but it can be called a number of things. So then we'll go to the next phase. And at that level, we'll dig usually square test units or maybe a trench, like a 1x2, or maybe we'll get a backhoe and we'll dig a trench in a dense artifact area to find out what else is there. And if we start finding features, indications of habitation, stuff like that, then we'll take it to the next phase, which is full-scale excavation. Now, I hear in the West, we don't have nearly as much soil deposition. So it's called a palimpsest of history out here, which means you can have artifacts from 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 14,000 years ago, sitting on the surface because of two things. One, there's very little soil deposition. There's not a lot of created soil because, let's be honest, sagebrush, creosote, and juniper trees don't create that much soil. So there's very little soil creation, and then when we do get that occasional rain, it washes all the soil away, down into those dry lake beds that Joe was mentioning in the first segment. So, you know, all that sediment gets washed down the hill, and we're left with these artifacts just sitting on the surface. So now it's up to archaeologists to use other methods to determine the antiquity of these things. How old are they? And a lot of times we do that by shape and things like that. But I'm getting off topic. The point is, that's what we do. So on this particular project, we were spaced out 10 to 15 meters, and we were just archaeologists walking in a line, and we were marching down this transmission line corridor. It was about 90 miles long and about 100 meters wide, I think, and a meter is about 3 feet, so you can factor that in. So it was about 100 meters wide, and we're just basically walking along at 10 to 15-meter intervals, and you might ask why we're not walking, you know, shoulder to shoulder so we can find everything. Well, the short answer to that is money. If we had the money, we probably would do that. And I'm looking at ways to do that via drone survey. However, What we're actually looking for are big habitation sites. We're looking for those places where people lived, not necessarily where they happened to drop something while they were going from one place to the next. Now, if we do find those things, they're called isolates, isolated finds, like the pot drops I mentioned earlier. When we do find those things, obviously we're ethically obligated to record those, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to halt construction because it's not there's no sensitive way to say this, but it's not culturally significant enough to the big picture as a whole to warrant moving it or something like that. And actually, we have Native American monitors from representative tribes in those different areas, and they agree with us on that. So at least we have that correlation. So what we're looking for is the bigger habitation sites. And if we do find something that has, say, lithics or what we call the debitage, which is the little flakes from making arrowheads and what we call projectile points. We don't typically call them arrowheads because they could have been spear points. They could have been arrow points. They could have been dart points. So projectile point covers all of those. So the debitage, it's called, is the word for the flakes that come off of that. So we find a bunch of that, and then we find maybe some ceramic stuff. Ceramics are a really good indication of a habitation site because they typically didn't move around with that very much. You know, they would stop one place and use those things and make them, and then they lived there for a little while. And then grinding stones as well. So any place where, again, there used to be a lake out there, so there would have been, I think there were pinyon out there, so they would have had nuts and seeds and things like that. They would have ground and done different things too. So you find these grinding stone sites. Again, not very mobile objects. So when you find that kind of stuff, it's typically an indicator that somebody stayed there for a long time. And we're really interested in stuff like that. Not that the temporary stuff isn't as important to the story, but it just doesn't tell as good of a story. So it's really difficult to tell something from one little thing, but we can take all these little pieces and put them together, then we can tell a big story. So that's what we're looking for, and that's why we have the interval spacing that we do. So anytime we find something, we come together, we look around in a 20 to 30 meter radius and say, is there anything else? If there's nothing else, then we record it as an isolated find. If there is something else, then we record it as an archaeological site, and then an evaluation through these processes are done later. And typically they're evaluated to determine whether they're eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. And it doesn't mean they will be registered, but we check it for evaluation of whether or not it's capable of that. Hey everybody, Chris Webster here from the Archaeology Podcast Network to talk about Timular, one of our affiliates. Head over to archpodnet.com/Timular. Click through there and you'll see this 8-sided cube that I use for tracking all my time as a project manager, all my time between the Archaeology Podcast Network and everything else I do. All you do is label the sides and then you flip it for each thing that you do, and it tracks your time exactly. You're able to export that as an Excel spreadsheet or CSV file to add to your timesheet. So if you're doing project tracking or any sort of tracking, then use Timular. If you're out in the field, you can actually use it on just your mobile device as well. So get Timular at archpodnet.com/Timular. Help support them and support archaeological education and outreach. So survey intervals, section 106. All right, so what are we looking for? Well, typically, by the letter of the regulations that we work under, it's anything older than 50 years. Now, some of you might be listening for this saying, well, if I was walking out there, you'd record me. And that's actually true. I just turned 44, so in 6 years, I'll have to submit myself to the National Register of Historic Places. And I believe I told my dad I was going to submit him, too, when he turned 50. But I did not. You can't actually submit a person, so don't worry about it if you're over the age of 50. However, you are historic in other ways, in that you have this, you know, vast amount of knowledge, which, you know, is a historic resource, I would say. But anyway, we're looking for anything older than 50 years. So in 2019, that means 1969, which ends up getting a little problematic because, you know, you might think as we get later on in years, things were easier to date, but they started using interesting codes and different dots and things on stuff, on bottles and cans and things like that. And a lot of times this stuff wasn't very well documented. So we do know some things like, you know, flat top beverage cans were aluminum and metal. Moving into the late 50s and the 60s versus all metal before that. They started having the pull tabs. Everybody remembers the little aluminum tab that you pull off of there that you can still find on like some tomato juice cans and things like that. And then, you know, cans went to all aluminum. Bottles started to change. Again, they were getting these little registration marks on the bottom so they could be read by different machines and stuff like that. So that's getting up into the 70s and then into the 80s. So it's going to get a little more interesting as we go through the years. And there's a lot of archaeologists talking about just arbitrarily setting a date at which we record stuff in some areas. But I don't know if that's ever going to happen. So anyway, that's typically what we're looking for. And that, again, means anything from 1969 all the way back as far back as you can possibly imagine. And people were here 10 to 14,000 years ago, depending on where you're at. So that's what we're looking for. Where does the information go? Well, we were on BLM land, so we were on government land. So technically, all that information is going to be recorded by the archaeology firm that was doing that, and then it's going to be submitted to the BLM district office for that area, and then it will be in those files, and you have to be an archaeologist typically or have some other reason that you'll have to talk to them about in order to access those files. And that's why we call a lot of this work gray literature. It's up to the archaeologists themselves to publish independently about some of this stuff. Because if you want to go find the report, typically that's problematic. It's confidential because there's locations of sites and things like that in there, and we don't want people going and looting them. So anyway, let me talk about working where we did. I say I was working on the Mexican border, but the reality is the entire transmission line did parallel the Mexican border and Interstate 8, which Interstate 8 is hundreds of feet from the border and sometimes, you know, really close. But we were down there, and it moved all around because it wasn't exactly linear. It didn't exactly follow Interstate 8, and for various reasons, I don't know. I think they had alternate routes and stuff like that. But one section of it that was about 14 miles long, I think, did actually parallel right down on the border. And in case you didn't know, there's a canal down there called the All-American Canal. And so the order where I'm going to discuss here goes Interstate 8. You've got maybe fluctuating distance of 300 to 500 or 600 feet, a huge, huge berm, and then this really wide, deep, fairly swiftly moving canal, and then you've got anywhere from, I don't know, a quarter mile to a half a mile of desert, and then the Mexican border. It's right there. And at that particular point, all along there, between El Centro and Central California and Yuma, Arizona, the portions I could see, it was all fence. Like, there's actually a border fence. I mean, people say we need to build a wall, but I'll tell you what, it's a pretty tall fence with some razor wire on the top of it. It's not the easiest thing to get over, I can imagine, which is what I'm going to talk about right now in the last few minutes here. So the shocking thing to me about working down there, and I'd never worked in that environment, was between the All-American Canal and Interstate 8. So, you know, they've already crossed the desert, anybody that's gone over the fence, and they got to the canal. But between the canal and Interstate 8, it was all empty water bottles, which I would expect, and then inner tubes, popped inner tubes, sometimes inflated ones, popped inner tubes typically, life rafts, life jackets, sometimes clothing, but typically these flotation devices. And I'm like, wow, I never would have actually expected that. For some reason, I just didn't. It wasn't something I conceived of as being things that we would find. Of course, we weren't recording these things because they weren't old enough, but I'll talk about that in a second. But it was just a little bit shocking to me because, I mean, it's 100 degrees out. We're well prepared. We've got 5 liters of water in my backpack, and everything's, you know, we're still hot and hating life because we're walking in the desert for 8 hours a day. But then I'm looking at these things and going, man, these people, the struggles that they went through, and the preparedness and bringing these things over just so they could get across that canal, because that canal is no joke. I mean, it's really difficult to get across. And then getting over and then obviously discarding those items in the desert, because what else are they going to do with them? But that was really shocking to me. And then another section of the transmission line was on the other side of the canal. So that's kind of a no man's land in some of those areas. In some areas, there's dunes and sand dunes, and there's people out there just recreating. I mean, you can drive right up to the fence and put your hands on it if you want to. Nobody's going to stop you. Well, Border Patrol is probably going to stop you. They stop everybody, though. They stopped us literally every single day, just about. So anyway, in that particular area, because of the canal and the crossings for the canal were monitored and gated and guarded by the Bureau of Reclamation, I think, who runs the dam operations there and the hydroelectric generation. So anyway, we had to get across there. It's still BLM land, but there's nobody out there. So we were stopped by Border Patrol frequently because they didn't talk to each other. And they were always out there saying, you know, hey, what are you guys doing? Who are you? Things like that. And the interesting thing to me is we didn't find any flotation devices. Obviously, you wouldn't on that side of the canal because nobody's going back into Mexico over that direction. So, but I would have thought we would have found some. But some of the artifacts we did find related to immigration, and I say artifacts because even though they're not old enough for us to record, they're still related to somebody's story. So they're still artifacts. I mean, my cell phone sitting in front of me is an artifact, even though I currently use it. That doesn't mean it's not an artifact. So, but some of the things that we found were, again, equally shocking. I mean, just the water bottles, the clothing, and some of the clothing choices. That's one of the big things I really thought about while I was there is we are so well prepared for this. You know, like I said, we were carrying – I had a 3-liter Camelback, and I had usually 2 to 3 liters of additional water in my backpack. And we go through it, I mean, because you're walking all day long in the hot sun. And it wasn't even that hot. I mean, it was probably in the 80s to, it, you know, hundreds by the time I left there. But low 80s, upper 70s is not that bad down there. But it's super dry. There's snakes. There's rattlesnakes. There's other snakes that'll get you. There's all kinds of – just the vegetation alone is really prickly and sharp sometimes. And, I mean, even if you just trip over some creosote, I mean, that creosote will just jam right into your leg if you don't do it right. And like I said, we're well prepared. It's well lit because it's daylight. I can only imagine coming across that landscape in the dark, relatively unprepared for the most part, and, you know, maybe not having enough water. I don't know, you know, how people are dressed when they do this, but I can only imagine that they're not prepared for it. And we saw evidence for people that, you know, quite frankly, didn't make it. And it was shocking and sad and really brought the whole border and immigration issue to the forefront in my mind. So I'm not going to speak too much more about that. It's just, like I said, it's shocking. And going back to thinking about this prehistorically and thinking about borders, we did find a lot of prehistoric material out there, typically ceramic pot drops, as I mentioned earlier. And those pot drops were really interesting to me. Because obviously that's back in a time when people were freely moving across the landscape. Again, there probably was a concept of territory, not necessarily a border so much maybe, but definitely territory. And now because somebody threw up a line, all of a sudden it's a different thing, right? And I was talking to some of the Native American monitors, and they're talking about, you know, hey, this is our land, you know, our ancestral homeland. And, you know, so when we're recording these ceramics, they're thinking about that stuff in the context of their own ancestors because they've been there for, in their, I guess, cultural, history, they've been there forever. Right. So when we're thinking about that, I mean, these guys, they can't do anything on the other side of the border, right? They have no influence, no political influence on the other side of the U.S.-Mexican border. But culturally, of course they do, right? The borders were only put up, you know, within the last couple hundred years in some cases and in some areas. And it's just, it's so fascinating to me, these political constructs that we throw up that the world, the earth itself, you know, typically could care less about. And then historically, you know, we could care less either. But what does that look like? You know, as I mentioned at the start of this segment, what does that look like? This sort of thought experiment about not having any borders. You know, what would the planet look like after 100 years of not having any borders? We go through a few generations of that happening. What does it look like? A resource I want to mention before I forget here is Jason De Leon, Dr. Jason De Leon. He's done a lot of research down there. He wrote a book called The Land of Open Graves about a lot of stuff in Mexico and on the border and how U.S. immigration policy has a direct impact on the human consequences of that whole equation. And you can find, obviously look up A Land of Open Graves, The Land of Open Graves. It's a book, you can find it on Amazon or anywhere. But his website, JasonPatrickDeLeon.com, and DeLeon is DeLeon.com. So JasonPatrickDeLeon.com. Look that up. He's got a lot of stuff on there. He's written some other works on there that he talks about, and it's just fascinating thinking about this stuff. Again, it feels a little impersonal to step back and look at it as data, but we have to look back at it as data so we can then tell the story, right? If we start by just telling the story, then it's not an accurate story. We have to look at it as data first, collect the data, and then analyze the data, and then tell the story as best we can based on those data. And it's just a fascinating experience and a fascinating talk. So yeah, if you have any thoughts on that, feel free to email me, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, or you can tweet me @ArchaeoWebby or @ArcPodNet. All right, so for 2.5 weeks of that 3 weeks I was gone, I was on that project, and then for the last half, I was at the biggest conference we have for archaeology in the United States, and I would say arguably in this half of the world, if not the entire world. There's some other big conferences out there, but this one's pretty big. There were, from what I heard, 4,800 archaeologists that pre-signed up for it, and there's a lot that show up and just show up for a day. So there's well over 5,000 archaeologists at this event. And it's called the Society for American Archaeology. And they put out a publication called American Antiquity, which some people may have heard of. But so we went there. And but what I want to talk about is not necessarily the Society for American Archaeology. I want to talk about what happened there. And without going into too much detail, there was basically a professor at the University of Alaska, and you can look this up pretty easily online. I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want him getting clicks, but he was up for he applied a couple years ago for emeritus status, which is what professors do when they retire. And then all this stuff came out. People started coming out of the woodwork, women that he had harassed or sexually abused, and over the years in one way, shape, or form. And they ended up denying him that status. And, you know, the Alaska Archaeological Association removed him. He had a Lifetime Achievement Award. They removed all that. And they got rid of all of it. Well, he was at this conference, apparently. And there's a journalist that's affiliated with archaeology, and he goes to all these conferences. And he saw this guy in one of the sessions and escorted him out. And the SAA leadership saw that. Basically, the journalists, I mean, as far as the letter of their ethical regulations go, harassed this guy by escorting him out, and they banned the journalist from the rest of the conference. Well, I'll tell you what, the backlash on that was strong, swift, and significant. And everybody was, of course, in support of the journalist that did this. And then the SAA organization came out and said that they basically said that they mishandled it, and they handled everything poorly. But, you know, the point is, it's archaeologists and sciences in general. You know, Me Too is a swift and significant thing. And I think that as scientists, you know, we tend to think that, I don't know, we tend to think that we're above it sometimes, which I don't think that's even right. But it tends to be seen that way. But all this can still be impacted, and you don't realize, especially me as a man, how my actions might affect somebody else and their development in this science, and what they're doing, and what they are careful about saying. Something I mentioned when we recorded a podcast about this on the CRM Archaeology Podcast, and you can look that up at the APN. Actually, just released that episode today. We talked about this kind of stuff in the workplace, because this is changing, but a lot of times you find that you're in a group of all guys on an archaeology project. There's a lot more women coming out, trust me, and it just so happened that it was mostly guys except for our field director, and then at one point there was another woman on our crew. But, you know, when all guys get together, they typically make these jokes, and it might seem like that's no big deal. It might seem like that it's because there's no women around, but you're just perpetuating this sort of behavior, and it's up to us in leadership positions to basically put a stop to that and say no to it. So, and just say, hey, these kinds of jokes aren't funny anymore. Whether they're racial or sexual or whatever the case may be, they're just not funny anymore, because they help enforce those divisions between us, and racial jokes help enforce tribalism and nationalism. Yeah, so it all comes back to that. Anyway, didn't want to end on a down note, but I do want to enforce that point that, you know, the Me Too movement is not relegated to just movie stars and politics. It's obviously affecting all of us, and we all need to think about it, so think about our actions. But back to Mexico, check out Jason De Leon's book, jasonpatrickdeleon.com, The Land of Open Graves. And if you want to ask me any questions about working down there and some of the other things we saw that I don't really want to talk about on the radio, then feel free to email me, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. I'm trying to get Jason on the podcast, if not on the radio show as well. So at some point in time, hopefully, we can get him interviewed and over here and talk about all this stuff. So That's pretty much all I've got for today. We'll be back next week. And I think the week after that, I'm in a conference in Oregon presenting about podcasting at the Archaeology Channel Film Festival. So I'll have some information on that coming back when we come back. So, again, thanks for listening to the show. Send me an email if you like the show. Just tell me, hey, you get something out of it. Chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. All right. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.